we're nowhere near where the digital will go in a few years. And where we are today is very different than where we were merely 3 to 5 years ago.
First, The Guardian, then BuzzFeed, and now it's official. The Huffington Post are opening up shop in Australia.
It's a pretty thorough courtship process that we have. We try to find a partner that sort of gets us the best of both worlds, but also brings their own sort of strengths and capabilities to the table.
So how will yet another foreign outlet change the media landscape? Well, get set to find out. Also coming up in this week's episode of Download This Show, imagine a chip that would allow you to control whether or not you can give birth with an app.
All these men and women should be free to decide whether they want to conceive a child.
And putting a paywall up around BitTorrent. Yep, all of the details up soon because this is your weekly dose of technology, the internet and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and right across the nation, welcome to Download This Show. And it is a big welcome to app developer and commentator Peter Marks. Welcome back to Download.
Thank you, Mark.
And she's the news editor for CNET Australia, Claire Riley. Welcome back to Download.
Thank you.
Now, first up, let's talk about sex.
This year, if you think about it, over a billion couples will have sex with one another. All these men and women should be free to decide whether they do or do not want to conceive a child. And they should be able to use one of these birth control methods to act on their decision.
Yes, that is the sound of Melinda Gates. Now, for years, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been on a quest to reinvent contraception with a particular view towards the third world. And this week, one of the startups that they've given $5 million to has come up with a very catchy idea. It is a small remote-controlled chip, a little bit like a digital Wi-Fi version of the pill, that will allow women to switch their fertility on and off with the touch of a button. This sounds amazing. Claire, walk me through exactly how does it work?
All right, so basically you've got a chip and it can last up to 16 years in the body, which is about half of a woman's reproductive cycle, reproductive lifespan rather. It's about 2 by 2 centimetres. It gives you a daily dose of a hormone, and basically inside the chip you've got these tiny little reservoirs that contain the hormone. When there's a minute electric current that goes through from a small battery contained inside the chip, It melts the seals around these tiny reservoirs and it releases the hormone into your body. You can turn it on and off with a remote control. There's sort of a bit of a precedent. Women listening to this might know Implanon, which is a contraceptive implant that goes inside your arm. It can stay there for about 3 years. So the idea of a long-term implant in your skin that controls contraception for you is not a totally new thing, but I think the digital aspect of this is the part that's most interesting.
Walk me through the practicalities of how do you go about delivering this? They're talking about delivery in 2018. What are the key sorts of things that they're going to be considering in that process?
Well, I understand from Melinda Gates' talk that one of the problems in particularly third world nations like African nations is that the women actually don't have a lot of control over their reproduction. And so they like something, they typically go and get an injection, which lasts for 3 months. And they like that because they are doing it separately from their husbands and they can sort of get away and actually not have to say much about it. Now, I don't know about this one. It's, you know, you say it can be put in just with an operation, but it's 2 centimetres by 2 centimetres. By 7 millimeters thick. Mm. It's actually quite a large device.
Certainly and bigger than Implanon, which is really like,
yeah,
it's like a pill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like chipping your cat or something. It's actually going to be a bit of an operation to
put it
under the skin.
Well, they say the procedure is 30 minutes. They've trialled it for osteoporosis patients.
Right.
So postmenopausal patients. It was a 30-day trial, so nowhere near as long in the body, but a 30-minute procedure, they say.
Just seems rather big. I mean, maybe you've got a lot of fat tissue lying around there where you can put
it
in without noticing.
Yeah, mate. We can't all be as thin and svelte as you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess the first consideration most people will be having listening to this is, can somebody hack my fallopian tubes? Like, what are the security considerations from that standpoint once you've introduced technology into the mix?
Look, I think it's interesting because we are seeing more of these I'm reticent to use the word cyborg, but yeah, I'll drop it out there. We're seeing this kind of fusion and blending of the human body with technology, whether it's for enhancement or whether it's for repair, you know, for a faulty part in us. We've seen people inserting NFC, RFID chips, the kind of contactless, the same technology used in contactless payments, inserting those under their skin. Scientists a couple of years ago got a woman to control a robotic hand with her brain. I think we're sort of pushing into this new territory, but it does bring a lot of ethical and kind of scary implications.
You mentioned NFC, and of course that's the risk, is this thing is apparently enabled or disabled by a remote being put close to the skin, and they do say that there's a password in it and it has some sort of encryption, but we know from people who've NFC hacked that they can make antennas that can work at more of a distance. But really, you've got to look at the motivation. I mean, why would someone want to actually flip someone's device on or off? I think the applications of this are more likely to be things like delivering insulin, things where there's actually some sensors under the skin doing blood analysis. That would be a really good way of doing it. I just don't know whether this is the right product.
Well, yeah, it's not just hormones. They've said that they could use it for other drugs. And I suppose the idea of flipping it on and off is, say you have it inserted when you're 20, it lasts for 16 years. You're not trying to conceive in your early 20s, but you might want to later, and then you might like to switch it back on if you've got three kids and you're happy with that number. I think when there are so many issues existing in the world around women's reproductive rights and, you know, old white men telling women how they should use their bodies, I think there is a risk with this, ethically speaking, that in the case of your African woman example, if she's concerned about her husband having control of her reproduction, is he going to take the remote from her? Is there going to be that kind of control issue?
Argument over the remote just got very serious.
I mean, in the TED Talk, Melinda is responding to this incredibly conservative view, and she has to make all these really basic points about how, you know, sex and reproduction, it's okay for them to be separate, and really, does she really have to even talk about this stuff in the modern world?
Well, that debate really does exist over in the United States in a massive way. I mean, there are issues where women are going into Congress and they're saying, well, hey, why are a whole bunch of, as I mentioned earlier, old white men controlling reproductive rights of women? I think this is a really empowering idea. It could be something really amazing that puts control into women's hands, but also at the same time, it's a two to do the horizontal tango. So, you know, there should be a conversation around not just putting all the burden onto one party.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the statistics she gives where in the Western world, it's something like 66% of couples use birth control. But in some of the developing nations, I think she said Chad had like 2% or something, and it's just extraordinary. So while you know, people might be saying, oh, ethically, we shouldn't be having, you know, contraception or forcing it on people. On the other hand, if they're having babies which are starving or dying, then, you know, maybe our idea of these ethics is so simplistic that it's just a nonsense.
It's a different question over here compared to a country like Chad, certainly.
If it's been that difficult to get things like condoms and medical contraception into those places, how do we honestly expect that chips under the skin are going to travel even further?
Yeah, it does seem to be perhaps a bit of overkill. Look,
not overkill, but just like it's 10 times harder. You know,
but it's also you need to do it 10 times or even more, less.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you don't have to. It's not a single use device. It's in there for 16 years. It's like an inoculation. Hypothetically, you can go in and you can go to a community, and while there would be startup costs, you imagine they go down over time. You have a whole community that can now take control of their reproductive rights in a town where it might be difficult to have access to a regular pill, which you need to take the same time every day, or where you need to find access to condoms, things like that. I think that having the ability to say one time, you're set, you're good to go.
I've got to say that when we had two children, I went and had a vasectomy, and I cannot speak more highly of it. It's a great, no nonsense, don't have to worry about it, and it was all over. And I really, you know, I would urge all men to do that.
Right. Well, MIT say that the implant will be ready by 2018 and clinical trials are starting now, so we'll see how this one unfolds. Download This Show is what you're listening to. We're in the studio with Claire Riley, the news editor for CNET Australia, and Peter Marks, an app developer and tech commentator. Mark Fennell is my name. And they are one of the iconic mastheads of the digital age, the Huffington Post. It began in 2005 and rose to notoriety, particularly around the 2008 US election. And now they have a digital TV station of live streaming news. They've won a Pulitzer and they're about to set up shop in Australia.
We're really excited about entering Australia. We are now in 10 countries around the world. And these 10 countries comprise already half of all of our audiences, about 47% of our audiences. We started international only 3 years ago, and now they're half of all of our audiences. Super excited about Australia, and we're looking to launch there in the first quarter of next year. I am Kota Wong. I am the general manager of HuffPost's international business.
And you're ready for people to send you resumes now, right?
not quite. We haven't made an official announcement of who our partner will be. We always partner when we enter our market. So we haven't made an announcement on that yet, but we're very excited to go into the market.
Is there a sense of when that announcement might arrive?
Not yet. It'll be this year, but okay. Not specifically when. We have not chosen a partner yet.
Okay, how does that conversation go? Do you reach out to different publications already operating in the space? Do they approach you? Walk me through the process.
Yeah, so we reach out to publications. Publications reach out to us. It's a pretty thorough courtship process that we have. You know, we get to know a few different publishers or news sites in any particular region. We try to find a partner that sort of gets us the best of both worlds, that understands and will wholeheartedly take in the HuffPost DNA, but also brings their own sort of strengths and capabilities to the table, strong ties and commercial relationships in the local market.
Okay. Here in Australia, we've already had launch of The Guardian in Australia, The Daily Mail in Australia, also BuzzFeed as well. We're feeling a little colonized, I'll be honest. I'm curious, what do you do to stand out when you're entering a market where a lot of your nominal competitors have already set up shop?
We want to have a really good understanding of the market, and we know that doesn't come from us being colonizers and coming in and saying this is how it's done, right? So the really one big important thing for us is to hire local staff who have good sense of what content does really well for Australians and aren't simply going to replicate what they see in the US in that market. What is more popular than Abbott? Well, what are the issues, whether from climate change or relationship with Japan, budget cuts that really will resonate with people? If you take a look at, you know, HuffPost France, for example, there we have a joint venture with Le Monde, and that's a site that covers the full gamut of stuff, from politics to entertainment to lifestyle. For example, cute cats do not do well in France. For some reason, they don't find them as cute as we do in the US or in Australia. So we don't do it that much there.
I'm just agog that there is somewhere in the world that doesn't like cat videos. I mean, what in God's name does BuzzFeed France do? All right. Now, one of the other things that you have overseen at Huffington Post has been the launch of Huffington's fairly vast array of video projects. Take me back to the beginning, actually. What was the initial conversation about how you were going to handle video as the Huffington Post?
We made some pretty big investments in video in August 2012 when we launched HuffPost Live. And HuffPost Live is an online video network. We think of it as the sort of CNN of tomorrow. We have news coverage. We have a lot of really interesting interviews, and we've had some really solid successes with it. We get, in the short time since launch, it's just shy of 2 years now. We've, you know, hit over a billion video views. Now we're hitting over 100 million video views a month. We have some great sponsors as well, so it's commercially doing very well. But we're also not resting on our laurels. We're continually iterating, playing around with different formats, and trying out different things to continue to evolve the medium. Because video as a means for consuming content is also evolving, right? Between now and the beginning of this year, a lot more people are consuming video on mobile. Okay, so what kind of strategy is that? How do you tailor your content and your format to evolve with the way people are consuming video? So the eyeballs are there. I think the money will shift as the eyeballs shift. So if you look at the online video market, it's about a $3 to $4 billion US dollar market this year. That's much more than it was last year and much more than it was the year before. But if you look at the TV advertising market, that's about a $70 billion market, right? So the eyeballs have shifted to online. The money, as these industries change, usually follows right after. So I think you're going to see not just the consumption pattern change, so more and more people watching video online at their own time, at their own speed, to their own taste, but also you're going to see a shift in the economics of video, where the money that went into TV, traditional broadcast, is going to shift to online video.
Coda Wong there from the Huffington Post, who will be coming out to Australia to talk at the ADMA conference in late July, if you want to hear his expanded thoughts. Welcome back to our panel. We have Peter Marks, who's an app developer and tech commentator, and the news editor for CNET Australia, Claire Riley. All right, let's play a fun game. Of the broader media landscape, Crikey, the ABC, Fairfax, SBS, who do you think would be the perfect Huffington Post partner?
Well, I think in the United States, they've come under fire from some Republicans for being a little bit too left-leaning, for skewing their headlines a certain way and for taking certain angles on stories. So I think maybe some of the more conservative media we may be able to rule out.
So the Australian's out?
Well, not they could be, yeah, they're
Jared
out.
Henderson's Media Watch email out?
I don't think it would be either Fairfax or News, really, because yeah. it's going to compete directly with them as being a front-page masthead. But really, you know, there's a lot of other stories. They can just use the wire stories from AAP or Reuters or AFP like everybody else does. I mean, that's the joke about these mastheads now.
It's funny, though, because in France, they partner with Le Monde. So, I mean, you'd have to argue that would be the Fairfax of France there. So,
maybe, but in Japan, they partnered with Asahi, which is a hilarious company that makes television, makes newspapers and beer.
Yeah, I know their beer. That's
yeah, that's the only part of that brand.
It's the same company.
As I mentioned earlier, we've had a lot of launches of big international mastheads, BuzzFeed, Guardian, now Huffington Post. Looking at the success rate, what has worked for those guys? What should be Huffington Post be replicating in our media landscape?
The Daily Mail, to me, just looks like another Huffington Post. I mean, it's just a picture with every story. It's
several pictures with every story.
Yeah, my goodness. Right. I was saying earlier, it is a spew of trash. You know, the top story is so-and-so model takes her tan lines on holiday. Has Prince George been photoshopped?
And keep you that know, up, you're going to get a job out of
yeah,
this.
Yeah, totally. Like, oh, so many stories about like 25, sparklers think, and, like, engagement rings. And
but we are talking about the Daily Mail's website is the most visited newspaper website in the world, though. So it's definitely working for them.
I think what they've done, though, and this is potentially what Huffington Post could do or could not do, Daily Mail has got this really shareable content. So while a Facebook user, say, may not think that they're a tabloid reader, they may not think that they would buy into that whole trashy UK, you know,
okay,
tabloid
magazine,
press
hello.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. They are sharing the content because a lot of people don't realise where it's coming from these days. It's just cool link. Oh, has Prince George been photoshopped for that magazine cover? Yeah, I'll share that with some friends. It's not so much about the title that it's coming from. It's all just about getting those clicks from that kind of satellite story that does the rounds on the internet.
But what are we trying to do here? I mean, this is not news. This is entertainment. It's just people relaxing. I mean,
is
you
it
often
even
see,
entertainment?
But do we need another page that republishes the same bunch of wire stories and adds a little sliver on top? I'd like to see clean feeds so I can say, just give me the stuff that, say, the ABC has reported on itself, plus give me the stuff that Fairfax has. Let me sort them by genre and, you know, search for things that I want to find out about. And that way I don't have to see the same stories over and over.
Absolutely. And that's going to be the point of difference in this new media landscape. I mean, Huffington Post has been accused of being an aggregator that just compiles the same stuff that the other sites are compiling. They run that risk when they come into Australia. I think it'll probably be the same sort of thing. But if they can do that original content, those exclusive, those interesting stories where you're actually having a journalist do the hard work, that's what we want to see. And I think those sites that do that in the future, that are providing more analysis, they will thrive.
But in all fairness, though, I mean, CNET is an American company that you work for, but you do a lot lots of local content as well, but you mix it in with your American content, and that's your model.
And it's great because what we have is we don't have to spend our time covering iPhone rumors, the latest Samsung release, because we have a whole team that's dedicated. We provide local angles and content.
iPhone rumor reporter over there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do we comment on that anyway? But it's giving us more time to actually focus on Australian content. So, I mean, I just wrote a feature that was just about regional country towns and access to broadband and NBN in Australia. You get more time to free up your journalists to do that really good work. And I think that's where it can work.
And of course, the other element to Huffington Post launching is that they intend to do video from day one. Now, in the States, as you heard, their video offering is quite an engorged beast. They have rolling coverage. You can chat along the side. It's kind of an interesting new model for how to do rolling news. And it kind of comes alongside at the same time as the American network, ABC, are launching a 24-hour news channel that's just going straight to Apple TVs. In terms of how people deal with video news online, what do we know works? What do people want? Rolling news? Do they just want short bits? What do the Australian market respond to in your experiences?
I think the ability to dip in to longer form, but know that if there's something important happening, you're going to break from that and you're going to go to the breaking important news. A lot of these 24-hour services are tying in with other things like Twitter. They're talking to people on the ground. They're combining kind of old and new journalism into this one format.
You know, I find the TV news myself, there's only, and the same looking at a newspaper, the intersection between what's in a newspaper or what's in a fixed TV broadcast and my interest is like this tiny little overlap. There's almost nothing there.
Marks Venn diagram.
Yeah. Was it the known known and the unknown unknown and the middle bit is the sweet spot?
Yeah.
Well, it's getting very small. So I'd much rather use software to put together a news service that I want. I like some of the intelligent ones like Flipboard and Zeit, which I know is owned by CNN. But basically, on a software sense, they can learn and I can say, show me more like this and less
Peter's
like that.
News interest matrix.
That's a very interesting point. So if you've never heard of Flipboard and Zeit, they're basically primarily tablet and mobile apps, which aggregate a lot of news stories from around the place based on what you're interested in. And eventually, as you say,
they learn from you. They learn what you like. And you can literally say, show me less like this. And they go, oh, sorry, we'll try harder in the future. They are obviously putting ads in there now. So they'll say this is a 4-page story. And you get up to page 2 and it shows you an ad. And I assume the money is going back to the people who created the story, but who knows? But, you know, I think this kind of thing where it learns from me, because I do find I put on the 7 o'clock news. As soon as sport comes on, I'm leaving the room and waiting for the weather. I shouldn't have to do that.
All right. Download This Show is what you are listening to. This is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. We're in the studio with Claire Riley, the news editor for CNET Australia, and an app developer and tech commentator, Peter Marks. You can hear him on RN Breakfast every week. And finally, paywalls and BitTorrent. Now, BitTorrent is often the technology most associated with illegal file downloading. So the idea of combining paywalls and BitTorrent seems a little bit counterintuitive, but that is exactly what BitTorrent Inc., the company behind the very popular file sharing client uTorrent, are talking about. They're going to allow artists to charge for their content starting in September using a paywall option that is basically aiming to harness torrenting technology for legitimate revenue, for lack of a better term. So exactly how's it going to work, Peter?
Well, the idea is that they've got a big market there. They say there's 170 million BitTorrent users who they can show this stuff to. And we know that things like the Pirate Bay has been showing clips of new artists on the front page.
The Promo Bay, I believe it's called.
That's right. So, I mean, it's a good marketplace. These are people, for good or evil, who are able to download video themselves. They've obviously got enough bandwidth. They've got enough interest in the content. So they are a good market to go for. And, of course, BitTorrent is a technology for distributing files. It's not a business model in itself. So it's a great way to do it without having to pay a lot of hosting. They did have something called bundles, which was a couple of years ago, where they would bundle up. Now, I assume that there was some sort of DRM in there, because if it wasn't there, then wouldn't they have just used BitTorrent to then seed those bundles again? And they've had artists such as Public Enemy, The Pixies, Linkin Park and Madonna playing with that. But they did make a mistake in 2013. They tried to sell programs. I think they tried to sell Desperate Housewife episodes for, was it $20 each or some crazy price?
Bargain.
No, I'm sorry. No episode of Desperate Housewives is worth $20.
You have to pay me to watch it.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the idea is there. The idea is good. It's a good market to go for if they can just come up with a way of monetizing it. I think it could be successful.
To me, it feels like there's a cultural schism, that if you're somebody that torrents things, you somehow internalize that process as being a not paid environment. How do you make people make that leap?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you could have said the same thing about Spotify. People are able to stream music, and if they have to listen to a couple of ads to listen to their favourite album, but actually kind of sick of the ads, so maybe I want to pay to get a better experience. And that's what YouTube's recently done. They're bringing in that paid service so that if you want to get rid of the ads, you can get a better experience. That whole concept isn't a new one. I mean, BitTorrent's very very quick to say, well, hey guys, we're just providing a kind of protocol. Other people use it, you know. BitTorrent doesn't kill people.
Bullets do.
Yeah, exactly. but I think there will be a subset that are going to say, yeah, okay, I'm happy to pay for good content and I'm happy to pay for it being maybe in full HD or I want it to be timely. But the thing that's interesting for me is we've got the first producer that's going to create a show for the service, yeah. Marco Weber. He's going to do a show called Children of the Machine. And basically, if you like the first episode, you have a bit of a taste test and you say, yeah, I like that. I'll pay $10 to see the whole series. Once he's raised $2.5 million, he's going to develop and produce the whole series. Now, that's essentially asking BitTorrent users to do what they hate doing, which is paying for a service and then waiting for it to roll out on someone else's timeline.
Yeah, the whole point behind, the whole part of the reason why people BitTorrent so much is because it's faster. It's
yeah,
faster
they say,
than
I don't
waiting
wanna
for somebody else to deliver. Then asking them to, you know, here, watch a part and then wait 3 months.
Yeah, I don't want to wait for the broadcaster to tell me when to watch this. Also, if you pay the $10, he doesn't reach $2.5 million, you kind of lost your money. Now, this is potentially, he's more of an indie producer, so he's done films like 13th Floor and Igby Goes Down.
Yeah, he's got a track record.
Yeah, he does, but he's not your Michael Bay. But maybe that works, maybe that doesn't. Maybe the fact that he's a bit more, he's a bit more experimental or less risk-averse, it makes him a good candidate
for
this
kind of... explosions too, that'll save
money. Yeah, exactly, right? But maybe it'll need a Michael Bay to come on and say, all right, well, Transformers is going to be available quickly through this BitTorrent system. No one's going to pay for it.
No.
It's a terrible movie.
This is what I don't quite get my head around, which is, okay, once you've set up this system, first person downloads this, what's to stop them from just re-uploading it so that people can torrent it for free?
Well, they're obviously going to have some sort of DRM that says that the BitTorrent system is not going to accept, you know, republishing these. Obviously, they've got to share amongst people, but there must be a license key or some sort of DRM in there.
But hey, if you don't experiment, you never work out what works. And that is the show for today. A very big thank you to tech commentator and app developer Peter Marks. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Mark.
And Claire Riley is the editor. And Claire Riley is the news editor for CNET Australia. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, it was good to be here.
My name is Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.